Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on 1 Second After when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft, and someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. Well, Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world history in America as an independent press. Now, you know it and I know it. He said that night in 1880. Now, there's not one of you, he went on to say, who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand it would never appear in print. I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now you know it and I know it, and what folly is this toasting of an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Well, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program and this New World Order. The men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. So let's wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians, and let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and this Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000, Bible prophecy, and this New World Order, why don't you call and order our free compact disc package. Remember, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, and click onto the archives page. You can download it right there. georgegordon.org. Hey, we're talking about 1 Second After. It's called EMP, the electromagnetic pulse. It occurred one time naturally in historic times in 1859. It's called the Carrington effect. It was caused by plasma on the surface of the sun coming to the surface and being transmitted by what's known as solar wind to planet Earth, where it's called the Northern Lights or the solar flare. It disrupts our Earth's magnetic field. And in the process of doing that, the wires that are strung across the country, like telegraph wires, telephone wires, electric power grid wires, act as an antenna, and it absorbs this electrical pulse. And it knocks out transformers. And in 1859, it started fires in telegraph offices because of the electrical pulse would come through the wires into the telegraph key sitting on somebody's desk. It would heat up, melt it down, set the papers on fire on his desk. Now, in 1859, there wasn't very much in the way of wires and telegraph and electronics equipment out there, so it was no big deal. But today there is. And in the developed world of Western Europe and the United States and Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and so on, these industrial countries rely upon electric grids and electric power. Our entire civilization is dependent upon electricity. And when the power goes off, civilization stops right there. Now, we're going through a couple of three articles here, but I started off with a book called One Second After, which describes this phenomenon in the form of a novel written by William R. Forschen, F-O-R-S-T-C-H-E-N, with a foreword by former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. Now, there's a big, thick report. It's a 180-page report. I've got it here on my desk. It was put out by our government. It was a report to Congress by a commission. The commission was with specificity authorized by Congress to look into this EMP problem and give them a report. Well, on 9/11, when the report was due in, it was the 9/11 commission report. The report here on the EMP was put out the same day, and nobody paid any attention to it. It's your tax dollars at work, and nobody's read the report. It's called the Report of the Commission to Assess the Threat to the United States from Electromagnetic Pulse, EMP Attack. And they go through this thing with a fine-tooth comb. They take a look at container ships coming in, unloading containers at the ports, diesel-electric locomotives on railroad tracks. The railroad tracks act as an antenna, picks up the pulse, runs it down the track, runs it into the electric motor on the locomotives, and burns them out. They took a look at the electric power grid and these huge transformers. And there's about 300 of these huge transformers here in the United States. These are the ones that are at the power plants, you know, these humongous ones. Burns them all out. They're gone. Well, everything that's in use at the time the EMP hits. Now, if you're not in use, if you're not using it, you probably would survive. So it's not going to be a total wipeout. There will be some little niches and notches here and there that'll survive this, but not very many, and everybody's going to be affected by it one way or another. So the book, remember, is called One Second After. You need two of them. The second one is called The Last Babylon, written in 1959, which deals with a conventional nuclear attack and what the aftermath of it is likely to be like, how you're going to live in the aftermath of nuclear war. And if you're sitting there saying, well, I'd just soon die in the nuclear blast, you can forget that. You probably won't. You people in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago probably will, but for the rest of the people in the country, you know, living in Corinth, Mississippi, you people are going to survive it, and you'll have to live your lives after the nuclear attack. How are you going to get food, clothing, and shelter? You people in Dallas, Fort Worth, and Houston may not survive it, but all the rest of the people of Texas will, at least initially. So now what are you going to do? How are you going to deal with it? And that's what this commission report's all about when we're dealing with EMP. There's an event that's going to happen, that's going to occur. What we don't know is it going to be natural and be a solar flare, or is it going to be man-made caused by the Russians or the Chinese, or maybe even the Muslims? After all, they've got one country there that's nuclear-tipped. That's Pakistan. And Pakistan's government is about as solid as, about as solid as water on a windy day. And when that government collapses and the Taliban takes over, then what? And remember, the Russians have 64 satellites, 64, loaded with nuclear weapons, orbiting over America, Canada, Western Europe, Australia, and New Zealand every day. And if they're multiple warhead tipped like MIRV missiles, each one of those satellites could have, say five each. That's what the rockets have. And the warning time now that we used to have or used to count on that 30 minutes between launch and delivery, forget it. They've already been launched. They're up in orbit. And now once they're up in orbit, you don't know which one is going to cut loose, and you don't know where it's at. And you don't know which ones are up there, satellites that are nuclear operated, and those that are communication satellites. We don't know. And I'm not sure that you can knock one of them down anyway. Now, I'm reading to you from a report, and it's called Nuclear Electromagnetic Pulse. Nuclear Electromagnetic Pulse by Jerry Emanuelson. And you can get a copy of this report. It's www.futurescience.com. www.futurescience.com. 12-page report. Nuclear Electromagnetic Pulse. We're on page 5. Today, if just one of these 500 kiloton bombs, like the Mark 18, were detonated 300 miles above the central United States, the economy of the country would essentially be destroyed instantaneously. Very little of the country's electrical or electronic infrastructure would still be functional. It would likely be months or years before the electrical grid could be repaired because of the destruction of large numbers of transformers in the electrical power grid that are no longer made in the United States. Several countries today have the ability to produce a weapon similar to this 1952 bomb and send it to the necessary altitude. England tested a single-stage weapon with a yield of 720 kilotons called Orange Herald on May 31, 1957, and the number of countries with this ability will undoubtedly be increasing in the coming years. Here's an important statement in that paragraph. Let me get you this one again. Very little of the country's electrical or electronic infrastructure would still be functional. It would likely be months or years before electrical grid could be repaired because the destruction of large numbers of transformers in the electric power grid that are no longer made in the United States. So I underlined no longer made in the United States. Let me ask you this. Let's suppose that the Chinese are the guys that do the coup de grace on us, and it happens to be in China where these transformers are being made. After all, Westinghouse and General Electric moved their manufacturing facilities to China, remember? Now what are you going to do? Did you think they're going to sell you the replacement parts after they've destroyed them? Can you see the vulnerability here? You talk about a security problem, and all we can think about is national health care insurance. Huh? Healthcare insurance? Going on. The instantaneous destruction of the power grid would only occur primarily because of the widespread use of solid-state SCADAs. That's called a supervisory control and data acquisition device. How do you like that? SCADA, a supervisory control and data acquisition device in the power grid. These would all be destroyed by the E1 pulse, but could probably be replaced within a few weeks. The greater problem would be in restarting the power grid. No procedures have ever been developed for a black start of the entire power grid. Starting a large power generating station actually requires electricity. The greatest problem would be the loss of many critical large power transformers due to the geomagnetically induced currents for which no replacements could be obtained for at least 2 years. Got that? These transformers, there's 300 of them here in the United States. These transformers are the humongous transformers that they use at the power plant, for crying out loud, to step the power up to 1,000 kilovolts. To send them down those big transmission lines. They don't just have those down at the local True Value hardware store. They're not on the shelf. They have to be built. The loss of many of these power transformers would greatly complicate the restart of the parts of the grid that could be more quickly repaired. Now, I've got another report over here that says if the power grid goes down, it's going to pose another big problem. It takes electricity to start it up. All the nuclear power plants will be tripped off. So they're going to be down and out. Within a short period of time, with the power grid out and the transformers burned out, you have to shut down the coal-burning power plant. You can't just be generating electricity. It's got to go somewhere. Now, in trying to start this thing up, you can't start one of these power plants up unless you've got electricity from the next power plant down the road. Nobody's ever started one of these power plants before without electricity. Now, if you think they're just going to bring in a generator or a couple of diesel electric locomotives to start one of these things up, you know, I think we're whistling Dixie through a straw hat here. We've never had anything like this. We've got a vulnerability here, and everybody recognizes it. That's the crazy part. I never heard this. Last year, I could not have made this report. I'd never heard of EMP. Now that I've heard about it, now that I've got the commission report, now that I'm investigating, and I said, oh my God, where in the hell have these people been? How come we're talking about national health care insurance and we're not talking about EMPs, huh? This is more serious than the current economic meltdown. Let me show you why. Everything that we do in this country is dependent upon electricity. The Empire State Building can't function without electricity. You can't get from the street level up to the top floors there without elevators, kids. Most of the people who work in these buildings could not walk up there 100 flights or 50 flights or 25 flights up. Furthermore, when you get up there, these buildings cover a whole block. All of the interior corridors in there are without windows, for crying out loud. I was up in St. John's Hospital the other day in Springfield, and happened to go down to the cafeteria just for funsies there, get a cup of coffee while I was waiting around. And this St. John's Hospital is about two blocks in size, the big main building. It covers two blocks. It's humongous. It's about six or eight stories high. Covers two blocks. Well, when you go to the cafeteria, it sits in about the middle of these two blocks on the first floor. And you go down this corridor, you know, it's, 200 feet long. There's no windows inside this thing. You got corridors that run, you know, up and down inside this building. And there's no windows. It's all lit up. Hell, that's totally unusable as soon as there's a power outage. Now you're going to say, well, they've got diesel generators. They do. They do. They got two great big humongous diesel generators to run that hospital. Now here's what the problem is. The commission report says this. This EMP has three pulses, E1, E2, and E3. This E1 pulse is the one that's going to knock out all the electronics. You know, it's a fast-moving wave. Well, get this. All these diesel generators have electronic components to them. You know these digital readouts that you have? I'm sitting here at my desk, and I've got my Sharp EL1197G3 sitting on my desk, you know, with this digital readout over here. Now, it's plugged in to 120-volt service here, just plugged into the wall. And it's got a transformer in here that steps the power down from 120 to some kind of millivolts to run this thing. And as soon as this E1 comes in here, this thing's going to just fry right here on my desk, plugged into the circuit. Same thing is true here with these generators. They're all plugged into the power. They've got disconnects, I don't deny it, but these disconnects don't save you from the power surge that comes in either from the sun or from an EMP. And it will fry all of the circuitry that starts and stops this diesel generator. Now, can it be fixed? Well, certainly it can be fixed. You can go down to O'Reilly's and buy the parts. But, you know, then you got Cox Health Center, and then you got Skaggs Health Center, and how many of these digital readouts and all this electronics equipment do you think they've got down here at O'Reilly's? You know, every diesel electric locomotive in the country is running on electronics. Let's wake up and smell the coffee here. Everything that we run, you take your elevators, those are digital, and they're electronic, and they've got computers in them to tell them when to stop at this floor or that floor or some others. Now, we've made a lot of progress. I remember the first elevator that I had ever seen, a manual elevator, it was run by a rope. You run by a rope. You got in the elevator, it was a freight elevator in the Harrison Apartments, and you pulled on this rope, and it made the connection, and the thing went up, and when you let go of the rope, it stopped. You know, when you pulled the rope in the other direction, it went down. Well, that was a manual switch. That elevator, if it's still in that building, will probably run after an electromagnetic impulse attack. But today, you know, we put electronic equipment, computers, into all these elevators to make them run. You know, you push the button and the thing stops, you know, automatically at every floor from here up. And every time we make one of these new electronic machines over here that runs on millivolts over here, when that pulse hit, it fries it. Can it be replaced? Sure, sure. I mean, you know, you can call the Otis people and they'll come out. Well, every elevator in Springfield is going to go out at the same time. Now, how long is it going to take Otis to get out there and fix all of their elevators? Now, here's another big problem. The Otis company that makes all of these parts, you know, Teledyne and all these manufacturers that manufacture these things, all of their buildings and all of their factories run on electricity. So look at the problem that we have here with the Otis elevator. Just taking this just one isolated factoid here. The Otis company, let's say they have a factory in Los Angeles, California, that runs on electricity. It knocks out all of the Otis elevators nationwide. Well, most of them, you know, we'll get them all, but it'll get most of them. And so now all these people are making orders. How are they making orders to the Otis company without electricity? Can the postal service operate without electricity? Can the telephone company operate without electricity? How in the hell are you going to get your order in to the Otis company in Los Angeles, California, without telephones, telegraphs, computers, emails, and etc.? Now, let's suppose that we send it by Pony Express. We'll send somebody on horseback. We'll hire an Amish guy with a horse, and we'll send him out here from Isabella, Missouri, or from Springfield, Missouri, to Los Angeles. Look up the Otis factory. What in the hell are they going to do out there? They all operate on computers. They all operate on electricity. They probably couldn't even find the parts that you need to fix your elevator at St. John's in Springfield. They wouldn't have any lights in the factory. O'Reilly's isn't going to have any lights in their stores. How are they going to find the parts? All of these parts now are on computer. When you go into the O'Reilly store, you tell them you want something, they punch it into the computer, and it tells them where it's at. Used to be they had books in there, and they'd look it up in their book, and then the book would, you know, tell them what shelf it's on. You'd walk in the back and pick it off the shelf. Today they don't do that. In fact, in our local O'Reilly store here, when we want to buy a part, I can guarantee you they ain't going to have it. I don't care what it is. You go in there and want to buy a starter for your 1999 Chevy Sierra, they're not going to have it. They'll have it tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. It comes out of the warehouse in Springfield. So if this EMP thing comes and I need a starter for my car, I've got to walk to Gainesville. My car ain't running, remember? When I get to Gainesville, the O'Reilly store doesn't have any electric power because the electric grid's down. I tell you, boys and girls, the only people that are going to get through this without a scratch are the Amish and Mennonites. They don't need any starters, and they don't use electricity to start with. Those people won't even know there's a problem and probably won't care. But for the rest of us, and that's the purpose for this report, Now, by mentioning the 1952 Mark 18 bomb, I don't want to imply that countries developing nuclear weapons would start with such an old technology. New automobile companies do not start with a Stanley Steamer or a Model T. The new radio companies do not start with Marconi circuits and Fleming valves. Modern techniques and materials, as well as advanced computing power, enable new nuclear weapons and weapons projects to leapfrog far past the Manhattan Project. A related fallacy is the belief that because of the difficulty that the United States and Russia had in going from basic fission weapons to thermonuclear weapons, all nations would experience similar difficulties and delays. Producing basic fission weapons requires a significant industrial capacity to produce the fissionable material. Scaling up from there just requires computing power and knowledge. Many years after he left the nuclear weapons laboratories, the principal designer of the Mark 18 bomb wrote an article for Scientific American describing in general terms how specific effects of nuclear weapons, including EMP, can be greatly enhanced, and how such effects can be concentrated in one direction from the detonation. He wrote that in Scientific American. His name is Theodore B. Taylor. The title of the article was Third Generation Nuclear Weapons. It's located on page 30 through 39 in volume 256, number 4, published in April 1987. Now, the Soviet Union got its surprise introduction to the severity of nuclear EMP effects over a much more heavily populated area than the Pacific Ocean. The most damaging nuclear EMP event in history so far, much worse than the Starfish prime test, it occurred in October of 1962 over Central Asia. Written documents give the time and date as 3:41 GMT. On the morning of October 22, 1962, the warhead was launched from Kapustan Yar on a Soviet R-12 missile, although the primary purpose of the test was to discover the effects of EMP on certain military systems. The large magnitude of some of the effects on the civilian infrastructure were very unexpected. A few hours after the sun rose in Kazakhstan on that cloudy October morning, the Soviet Union detonated a 300-kiloton thermonuclear warhead in space at an altitude of 290 kilometers, that's about 180 miles, over a point just west of the city in central Kazakhstan. The test was generally known only as Test 184, although some Soviet documents refer to it as K3. It knocked out a major 1,000-kilometer, 600-mile underground power line running from Astana, then called Akmola, the capital city of Kazakhstan, to the city of Altmaty. Several fires were reported. In the city of Karagandy, the EMP started a fire in the city's electrical power plant, which was connected to the long underground power line. The EMP also knocked out a major 570-kilometer-long overhead telephone line by inducing currents of 1,500 to 3,400 amps in the line. The line was separated into several sublines connected by repeater stations. There were numerous gas-filled overvoltage protectors and fuses along the telephone line. All of the overvoltage protectors fired, and all of the fuses on the line were blown. The EMP damaged radios at 600 kilometers, 360 miles from the test, and knocked out a radar 1,000 kilometers, 600 miles from the detonation site. Some military diesel generators were also damaged. The repeated damage to the diesel generators from the E-1 component of the pulse after the series high-altitude tests was the most surprising aspect of the damage for the Soviet scientists. Subsequent analysis has shown that the warhead used back in 1962... the Soviet test was particularly ineffective at generating EMP. If the W-49 warhead used in the U.S. Starfish Prime test had been used in the Soviet test, the EMP damage over Kazakhstan would have been far greater. Now, both the United States and the Soviet Union detonated EMP-generating nuclear weapons tests in space during the darkest days of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the world was already on the brink of a nuclear war. The Soviet Union detonated additional 300 kiloton weapons over Kazakhstan on October 28th and November 1st, 1962. The United States detonated a relatively small nuclear weapon, about 7 kilotons, in space over the Pacific Ocean on October the 20th, 1962, and also detonated a 410 kiloton nuclear weapon in space over the Pacific on October 26th and on November the 1st, 1962. During the period of October 13th to November 1st, 1962, there were 16 Soviet and 6 nuclear bombs from the United States above ground nuclear explosions. 2 people suffered retinal burns when they looked toward the nighttime flash of the October 26th Bluegill detonation directly overhead, which occurred at an altitude of 50 kilometers. Due to a guidance system malfunction, the October 26th detonation occurred almost directly above Johnston Island. Now, most of the EMP data on the United States Bluegill, Checkmate, and Kingfish high-altitude tests of 1962, as well as the hard-tack teak and hard-tack orange tests of 1958, remains classified decades after the tests have been completed. The secrecy regarding these tests poses a danger to the United States, since it does not allow vulnerable United States citizens to fully educate themselves about the effects of these weapons that could have a dramatic effect on their lives in the future. Test 184 was launched from Russian territory about 30 miles from the Kazakhstan border. If Test 184 were to be duplicated today, using the same launch and detonation points, it would be considered as a nuclear attack against another country. At the time, of course, Kazakhstan was a part of the Soviet Union. Now, there is a separate page with more details about the Soviet nuclear EMP tests in 1962. This site is written by an electronics engineer who has been concerned about the possibility of an EMP attack on the United States for several decades. We are now entering a period of special vulnerability to EMP in the coming years as industrial civilization becomes almost totally dependent upon microelectronics. Most people who have some knowledge in this subject and who have given some serious thought to the problem consider the probability of an EMP attack on the United States during the next 10 years at somewhere between 20 and 70%. The probability of a solar storm large enough to destroy hundreds of the large transformers in the United States power grid sometime during this century is widely considered to be more than 50%. My own guess is that the probability of a long-term loss of much of the world's power grid from a solar superstorm is probably much larger than the chance of a nuclear EMP attack on the United States by some foreign power. The time that it would take to recover from an EMP attack has generally been estimated to be anywhere from 2 months to 3 years. There would almost certainly be a time of great economic hardship. Whether this time of economic hardship is of short or long duration will depend upon the reaction of the American people after the event and whether any preparation has been made in advance of the event. So far, such advance preparation has been almost totally absent. In widespread power outages of the past in the United States, people have reacted with behavior ranging from rioting and looting, as many did during the July 13, 1977 New York power outage, to patiently waiting for the crisis to be over, as has occurred with some more recent power outages, such as the widespread August 14, 2003 outage in the northeastern United States. The Power Grid DVD from the History Channel examines the electric power grid with special emphasis on the August 14, 2003 blackout. If the recovery period were long, and especially if electronic communications were down for a period of months, civilization in the United States could reach a tipping point where recovery would become difficult or possibly even impossible. The electric power grid in use today has changed very little from the system first devised by Nikola Tesla and implemented by Westinghouse beginning in the 1890s, as described in the Mad Electricity DVD, which describes the power grid from the historical perspective of Tesla's early battle against Thomas Edison for the adaptation of alternating current. This adaptation of alternating current made modern electrification possible, but it also has made the power grid very vulnerable to geomagnetically induced currents, which includes the E3 component of an EMP as well as severe solar storms. A nuclear EMP attack could come from many sources. A missile launched from the ocean near the coast of the United States and capable of delivering a nuclear weapon at least 1,000 miles inland toward the central United States would cause problems that would be devastating for the entire country. A thin-cased 100-kiloton weapon optimized for gamma-ray production, or even the relatively primitive super-Oroloy bomb of more than 56 years ago, detonated 250 to 300 miles above Nebraska, would destroy just about every unprotected electronic device in the continental United States, southern Canada, and northern Mexico. Such a weapon would also knock out 70 to 100% of the electrical grid in this very large area. Nearly all unprotected electronic communication systems would be knocked out. In the best of circumstances, as completely unprepared for such an event as we are now, reconstruction would take at least 3 years if the weapon were large enough to destroy large power grid transformers. I want to put a bracket by that paragraph, and let's take a second and think about this for a minute. Let's suppose that you were the chief architect of the attack from Russia. Would you launch just one weapon over Nebraska? Or would you launch three or maybe six weapons to make sure that you did the job upright? All right, let's take a break right here, and let me give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4900. 67. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, click on to the archives page, and download it right there. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, do not mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about EMP, reviewing two books. One is called One Second After. The guy's name is William R. Forstchen, F-O-R-S-T-C-H-E-N. We bought that one. It's relatively new. It's 2009 is the publication date, and we got it at Barnes & Noble. I don't know what the price is. Let's see if they got a number on here. I can't imagine it being over $20. And worth every penny of $20. Worth every penny of 30 or 40. I don't see a number in here. I don't know what the price is. Copyright 2009. The other book over here, Last Babylon, you might have to get that one from a used bookstore, although it was last published, it came out in 1958-59, and it was last published by HarperCollins in 1993. Last published in 1993. Alas, Babylon. The author is Pat Frank. Now, both of these explore nuclear attacks, nuclear survivability. One Second After deals with EMP, the report that I'm reading from right now, called www.futurescience.com. That's the source. It's called Nuclear Electromagnetic Pulse by Jerry Emanuelson. Now, this guy Emanuelson now over here is an electronics expert. And he's taking the information primarily from the commission, the Congressional Commission, that put this together in... what was the year? 2008, I believe it was. 2008, yep, April 2008. It's called the Report of the Commission to Assess the Threat to the United States from Electromagnetic Pulse Attack. Critical National Infrastructures. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 members on the commission. And one of them is General Richard L. Lawson, U.S. Air Force, retired. Dr. William R. Graham, the chairman, and it's a 180-page report. And I don't know where this came from. I don't have an address here on the internet. I think if you did a Google search, you'd probably find it. And I found it on my desk this morning. Dirk typed it out last night or printed it out. It's April 2008. It's called The Report of the Commission to Assess the Threat to the United States from Electromagnetic Pulse EMP Attack. Critical National Infrastructures. Do a Google search, see if you can get it. That's if you want the whole report. Now, it's 180 pages long. You may want these brief reports. This is a report on the report. All right, now the more that preparations are made for an EMP attack, the less severe the long-term consequences are likely to become. In comparative terms, being ready for an EMP attack would not cost a whole lot, and the benefits would include a much higher reliability of the electrical and electronic infrastructure, even if a nuclear EMP attack never occurred, kind of like YK2 or Y2K. Adequate preparation and protection could keep recovery time to a month or two, but such preparations have never been made, and few people are interested in making such preparations. Well, you can say that again. That's never going to happen. Nobody's ever going to prepare for this. Now, you as an individual might. We here at the law school, we're hardening our operations here. First of all, we can live without electricity here to start with, but, you know, electricity is kind of a neat thing to have. And especially your computers and electronic equipment. For instance, just going upstairs and looking at the counter in the kitchen, at all of the appliances that are sitting on the counter and are plugged in. See, every one of those will be fried. So what we're going to do here is harden those. Harden them so that they don't burn out when the EMP pulse comes. Same thing with laptop computers. There's a thing here called a Faraday cage. I said last time we'd get into that. Maybe I'll do it next time. But a Faraday cage. You can build this yourself, or you can construct one to protect your car, to protect your computers, to protect your appliances, especially your radios. Now, I've got a couple of radios here that have multiple bands, including shortwave, AM, FM, And there's a couple other bands on there. I forgot what they are. And they're both wind-up hand radios that came from South Africa, where, you know, people live without electricity out in the bush. You wind it up, and the radio plays for 30 minutes. Take 60 seconds to wind it up, and it plays for 30 minutes. 60 seconds to wind it up, and it plays for 30 minutes. But it's electronic. You know, it's not an old vacuum tube radio, you know, from the 1930s or 40s. It's an electronic circuitry radio. When this EMP happens, those two radios are toast. So what do we do to protect them? Well, take this down. Call Faraday Cage. You can do a Google search on this, and it'll give you some more information, and I'll give you some more in the next program or two. But here's what a Faraday cage is. It's a garbage can. You could actually make this with a garbage can and stick your radio inside the garbage can, and it'll protect it. Now, a garbage can isn't the best. They recommend here that you use either copper, that's copper screen, or aluminum screen. Not metal, not ferrous metal, but aluminum or copper. Copper's best, aluminum, though, will work. And you put the radio in its box. Then you put the box into a plastic bag. Then you wrap the plastic bag in aluminum or copper screen. Then you put that into a plastic bag and put a second layer of aluminum or copper screen around that. Then put that on a shelf, a wooden shelf that's insulated. That'll protect it. See how simple that is? It doesn't cost a lot, and it will protect those two radios. Then, when this event transpires, we'll have a radio to listen to any emergency broadcasts that can get through. And the shortwave bands are very important, because if this happens in the United States, we may be getting our information from Australia. You know, information may be coming from Mexico. Information may be coming from ham operators someplace operating shortwave radios. Now, you can rest assured that there's a lot of sharp people out there that are going to have protected equipment and transmitters, and they're going to have generators, and they'll have them hardened. and there will be some communications. But whether or not you'll be able to receive those communications will depend upon whether or not you've got a radio to receive it with. And if you think that your radio sitting up here, even your vacuum tube radios are vulnerable to this E1 pulse. These reports are pretty important to you. Now, hardening the electronic and electrical infrastructure of the United States against an EMP attack is the best way to assess and assure that such an attack doesn't occur. Leaving ourselves as totally vulnerable as we are now makes the United States a very tempting target for this kind of attack. By not protecting its electrical and electronic infrastructure against nuclear EMP, the United States invites and encourages nuclear proliferation. These unprotected infrastructures allow countries without a nuclear weapons program to eventually gain the capability to effectively destroy the United States with one or a few relatively simple nuclear weapons. Severe solar storms can cause current overloads on the power grid that are very similar to the slower E3 component of a nuclear electromagnetic pulse. There's good reason to believe that the past century of strong human reliance on the electrical system has also, fortunately for us, been an unusually quiet period for solar activity. We may not always be so lucky. In 1859, mark that number down, 1859, there was a solar flare. A solar flare produced a geomagnetic storm that was many times greater than anything that has occurred since the electrical grid has been put in place. We know something about the electrical disruption that the 1859 Carrington event is what that's called. And it's spelled C-A-R-R-I-N-G-T-O-N event. Put that into a Google search and it'll bring you up with a number of papers on this event from 1859. The Carrington event caused because of the destruction that it caused on telegraph systems in Europe and North America. Many people who have studied the 1859 event believe that if such a geomagnetic storm were to occur today, it would shut down the entire electrical grid of the United States. Let's underline that. If that same event, just a magnetic flare from the sun, called the Carrington event in 1859, if that were to happen today, it would shut down the entire electrical grid. Now, most of us think of the shutdown of the electrical grid as an inconvenience that will be repaired by the lineman, like it always is after a hurricane. You can perish the thought. That isn't going to happen. There's 300 of these super transformers in the United States, 300 of them. All of these transformers are hooked up to antennas called electric power lines. When this pulse hits those electric power lines, it will run DC current backward down the power line into these transformers and burn them up. That's what happens. When these 300 transformers are burned up, if we could place orders for them in China, where they are made, it would take 2 years to make 300 of those. 2 years to get 300 of them out. By then, all the electric power grid will be down. All of the generating plants will be down. These huge generating plants, you know, that turn out megawatts, they require tremendous amounts of electricity to start up. And all of these plants have to be shut down for maintenance every once in a while. And they shut them down. And then they repair them. And then they start them back up again. So far, we've always had electricity from the power grid to start these power plants back up. But if you turn all of them off, there will not be any electricity to start even the first one up. So you got to get the first one started up in order to start the second one, to start the third one, the fourth one, and the fifth one. We've never seen that happen before. Anybody here? There isn't any report anywhere that says if all of them go offline, here's how we start them up again. Nobody has ever done it. Now put that one in your pipe and smoke it. It's likely that such a geomagnetic storm would destroy most of the largest transformers in the electric grid. Spares for these large transformers are not kept on hand, and they are no longer produced in the United States. Let me underline that one again. They're not even produced in this country. That's why I raised the specter of, well, my God, if the Chinese were to do this to us, if they're the aggressors, and they're the guys that are in the possession of the manufacturing plants that produce these transformers, we'd be in the position then, in this country, of having to go to work to build the factories to build the transformers in this country. Now, what do you think of that? You know, when God said he was going to destroy us, I don't think that guy was whistling Dixie. Protection against nuclear EMP is also protection against many kinds of unpredictable natural phenomena that could be a catastrophe. Although it's possible that a nuclear EMP attack will never occur, a solar flare that will completely shut down the electrical grid for a very long period of time almost certainly will eventually occur unless adequate protections are put in place. For a comprehensive recent report on the effects of geomagnetic storms and the EMP E3 component, see Severe Space Weather Events, Understanding Societal and Economic Impacts by the National Research Council of the United States National Academies, a solar storm of the size of the 1859 event, or even a smaller geomagnetic storm that occurred on May 14th and 15th in 1921, could simultaneously knock out the power grids of the United States, Canada, Northern Europe, and Australia, with recovery times of 4 to 10 years. Since the solar storm would burn up large transformers worldwide, for which very few spares exist, the United States has no capacity for building replacements for these large transformers. Now, maybe you Australians do. Maybe you Canadians do. You know, maybe we Americans could say, hey, would you guys build some of these for us? And assuming that you could and would, you know, we might have a source of supply. Maybe we could get them from Europe. But I doubt seriously that we're going to get them from Russia and China, since it's more likely that those are the two antagonists that will probably torch off the EMP. Unless, of course, it's done by Pakistan, by the Taliban, or Al-Qaeda. After all, remember, the Muslims now have nuclear weapons in Pakistan. That's a Muslim country. And it's a very weak and unstable government. Now, that's something for you to chew over while we get ready for tomorrow's program, while we're talking about these EMPs. Meanwhile, back on the farm, let me give you a final reminder here for today's program that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. And all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. Got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So, until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.